Okay, that's Ernestine Anderson with All Blues. As you know, that tune is most associated with Miles Davis. He, of course, composed it. Lyrics were written by Oscar Brown Jr., and it was particularly well-suited for Ernestine Anderson's 1983 album, the title of the same song serving as the title of the track, as the title of the album. This is Utrece Lead, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.fm. I had a small laughable now, but it wasn't funny then. Emergency. I locked the door, but I was on the wrong side of it. I was in a hallway and couldn't get in. So I had to prevail upon the kindness of some help here and got me in. So it was kind of weird, feeling like you're trespassing in your own property. That drama's over. I'm here. Okay. I want to talk today about, let me just get this here. I'm settling in still. All right. I wanted to talk about to continue the conversation on where we left off yesterday. And that is about this season that we're in which we're talking about the police, the role of the police, the question of police violence, where we are as citizens controlled by police, the ways in which we interact with a police state. And we have some talking still to do. And today I thought I'd talk about this question of race, class, and abuse of power by police. As you know, the case continues of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis, the police officer who is said to be the executioner of where are my notes? I'm trying to find my notes because, among other things, my glasses are downstairs. Okay. But the trial continues. It's a very strange trial. And we have no way of really, as citizens, we have no way of having direct input. We just simply are observers now that a trial is on, and we are just observers, and we are looking on at how this process is unfolding. And we have to ask ourselves now, is this justice? Is this the way it's supposed to be? So we're talking today about race, class, and abuse of power by police. This police officer who is on trial now has come to represent the institution of police all across the nation. And he also represents the imposition, the unilateral imposition of power in times that we as citizens, we cannot control. We do not control. In some instances, a single police officer represents the power of the state, the unilateral power of the state. And very often it has to do with the outcome that we don't want, and that is dispatching people from life, depriving them of life. And there is the rub. Where does the power of the state end? If it does, where do our rights begin? How do we, in any instance where we have this this confrontation, how do we dare claim that we have rights as citizens? I mean, theoretically, we are told about that all the time. We have rights. But very often, and I've covered enough of these cases to see the commonality of it, it turns out that we do not have equal rights, citizens as opposed to the police. They have all the rights, including and especially the right to dispatch people from this earth under the guise that as representatives of the state, they are exercising good judgment. And the whole thing now transfers to the wrong actions of the individual who is killed. It's the individual now who is the problem. The police, we are to assume that they have greater rights. They have more rights because they are representing the power of the state. They're representing the state's assertion of that power. They are, in fact, trained to do that. So even in a trial where ordinarily we say, well, there's a case going on in court, the assumption being that all parties have rights, and the purpose of the trial is to decipher who went beyond the presumed rights that they have, and what is to be done in a supposedly civilized society when the citizen, the average citizen, comes up against this power and arbitrarily the police officer exercises final and arbitrary and instant power, including the decision to end a life, as was the case here. That's what we're talking about, in effect. When we come up against a situation like this, what is the role of the court? What is the reason for a trial? And so our focus today should be about this confrontation, the dynamic of a confrontation like this, because it's been played out thousands of times over the years. And in a court of law relating to this case and cases like it, where it is the power, the awesome and arbitrary power of the police officer to take somebody's life. And then they haggle out the differences and the details in what is a trial to determine who exceeded that power. Was that power appropriately exercised? We know, because we've covered thousands and thousands of cases, not me covering thousands and thousands, but the society as a whole, we've had to deal with thousands and thousands of cases in which this is the central question. And in that question is the question of race, class, and power. The same question turns up in other ways as well. We're going through our daily lives, but it is always present. And in situations like this, where a life is taken, the life of a citizen is taken, and the person responds, the other dynamic is that we have come up against this issue of race and class within the question of exercise of power and the losing of power and life. So I ask you today, how many more Derek Chauvin's, that's the police officer's name, who is alleged to be the killer of George Floyd? How many more Derek Chauvin's are there in the ranks of the nation's police departments? How many possibilities are there that we also have many more George Floyds? And where is the balance of power? Who has it? How do they get it? Even in a trial which is supposed to be impartial, we're kidding ourselves if we think that, in fact, we're watching an impartial situation in a court of law. It's not impartial, even though they tell us that. We know the background. We know the context. We know the environment. We know the history. So we should not pretend that it is a completely impartial process. And we're starting from scratch with the assumption that both parties, that of the citizen and that of the police officer, they're equal, even if one of them was killed by the other. That's the question I bring to you today. How many more Derek Chauvins are there in the ranks of the nation's police departments? How do we know? What do we do to find out? Do we wait until there is a citizen whose life is taken? Do we wait until there is a cataclysmic event and loaded with questions and contradictions? And still we are expected to give more weight, give more credence, more allowances to the actions of the officer and not of the person killed. How many more of these things do we have to go through, these trials, and pretend that it is about justice? It is not about justice. It is about deciding which individual we will allow to win the contest, the final contest. Who gets that consideration? Why? If you think you know the answer, or if you have an answer, please let us know at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We have to start asking these questions. Let's take a break so I can gather myself and come right back to you after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.fm. I'm your Trace Lead. We're trying to decipher the instant problem that we're having and have been having for a very long time. And that is, when it comes to a clash, a confrontation that proves to be lethal between police and citizens, are we even talking about fair, or are we talking about we have to make a choice? We decide arbitrarily, regardless of what the law is. We tend to make a decision based on entirely different requirements and parameters. We are talking about the clash. It is a confrontation with a system, a citizen and a system. And the transaction between citizen and system that controls the inevitability of what happens. And it's most often the case that the citizen loses. Even when there is a so-called trial. All right, Ed from Queens, you start us off today.
Hey, good afternoon, Patrice. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, Ed. How are you?
Well, you know me.
Mr. Thumbs.
Pertaining to your question as far as how many Derek Chauvins or potential officers of the same ilk are there? How many police are there in America? I mean, it's a question that's painfully obvious. I mean, as long as the idea of policing is kept the way it is in this country, we're always going to have this confrontation, because what I believe is the trappings of a capitalist society. The police are the strong arm of the state, and the state represents the ruling elite. And as long as that minority, as long as that separation is kept, we're always going to have confrontational circumstances between class, minority and class, or race and class are interchangeable. The poor are always going to be subject to the prevailing dementia of the police force. And the police force is going to be given an open hand because they are dependent upon to keep the status quo. And that's the main, as far as I'm concerned, that is the main problem. There are systemic issues in police departments based on their genesis, as far as in the South, slave catcher posses, and in the North, which relates to the English Council Fillery, how the police were paid, how certain segments of the population at different times were allowed to become police because it facilitated them, quote unquote, becoming white. There are several things wrong with the way policing is conducted in this country. And until those core issues are addressed, until we come up with an idea of what community safety is, what community policing is, and how best do the police and the community, which ideally should work together to protect the welfare of the community on the whole, instead of representing the minority, which is the ruling elite, we're always going to have these problems. The system itself protects itself. The prosecutor, the DA, is in an incestuous relationship with the police. So anytime a police officer comes in conflict of the law, he's already got a gratis protection from the system that is designed to prosecute lawlessness.
So why do we pretend that in most cases the system, this is a fair and equitable system that gives both the police officer or the errant police officer or officers and the citizens the same opportunity, the same consideration in terms of their actions, whether it ends in the death of the citizen or not.
Because America, look at America, the American dream. I mean, that statement alone in itself explains how America looks at itself, how Americans defuse themselves of these ideas that American exceptionalism, American democracy, it's an illusion. And we buy into this illusion because it's comfortable, because it's convenient, and because it supports the status quo. So, I mean, when you buy into an illusion, reality, the truth is hard. The truth is hard. The truth is a hard thing to accept for people. But the truth will set you free. And the truth of the matter is this democracy is a sham. And we're not getting the requirement that we need from it.
So, okay, let's say you were selected as a juror in a case like this. In this case, let's be more specific.
Yes.
What is your mindset going into court and getting ready to hear a trial?
Well, my mindset, even though I'm going to be totally honest with you, I will be biased because of my experiences with the police in New York and my education as far as how the system runs. It would be biased, but I look at it as an individual. You're an individual. You're performing a job. You're a police officer. You're a civil servant. You're performing a job. In the course of your, if a mailman killed somebody in the course of performing a job, that mailman would be guilty of murder. So you're a police officer. You have certain training. You have certain guidelines. You have certain rules and regulations that dictate how you respond to situations. Even though those situations are pressure-packed, even though the situations are life-threatening, you took the job and you knew the job was dangerous when you took it. And if you didn't operate within those parameters, if you blatantly and disregarded human life and killed an individual in the process of your job, then you're guilty of murder. You should be punished like anybody else.
Okay. From what you are observing in the course of this trial, which just started, what thoughts do you harbor in your head as to the likely outcome here?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, I haven't looked into it in depth. I've just started to since you talked about it yesterday. Unfortunately, I see the groundwork being laid, which has been for most cases when the police are convicted of, when the police are indicted of criminal activity. They're going to get off. I mean, like I said, the whole system that is designed to prosecute them depends on them. A DA depends on the police to make cases. The court system depends on the police to bring in to bring in suspects and to enforce law. So when you have a system that the major part of that system is interdependent on it, you're not going to get the vigorous prosecution and the adversarial pursuit that you would get if it was a civilian. Because the system knows, hey, if we spank them too hard, we might get recompense. Or we might not get what we need. There's too much interrelationship, and there's too much quantum entanglement with the judicial system, the police system. There's too much of that quantum entanglement in the criminal justice system to get a fair trial. I've always been for independent prosecutors. I've always been for an independent system outside itself to monitor the police.
Well, you got us off to a great start in terms of analysis of the situation, and with the added burden of walking us through your thinking on systems, because, you know, you have two systems here at work.
Yeah,
and we somebody has to pick which side you give your support to. Which side do you pick to prevail? And that pretty much is how a trial works. Despite all the claims about, you know, objectivity and fairness and so forth, this is what it comes down to.
You're going in with a stacked deck, because the court system is dependent on the police, and the police are dependent upon the court. So the deck is stacked from the beginning. So you're not going to get that. The idea of an adversarial justice system is two opposing forces searching for the truth, a defendant, a prosecutor, trying to establish a modicum of justice. You can't get that when one system is dependent on the other.
Thanks, Ed, for getting us started for getting us started so powerfully today. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Yatrice. I'm going to approach this from a different stand. And I'm looking at this situation in a way that people need to look at it that is very important. First of all, we have to understand that this is not a matter of government administration, including police versus citizens. It has little to do with that. We have to understand, as has been explained in Wilkerson's book, Cass, that we have here in this country a very powerful caste system. And this has a lot to do with where you belong in the caste system. Now, this is explained when you have to understand that the important castes. For example, the most important caste is called the white caste. Now, this white caste has ruling class people in it, the rich and the powerful, the plutocrats, and the middle white caste has the workers and even poor people. And when I say a caste system, the white caste, this includes people who have a certain complexion, a light, very light brown complexion, because there's no people that have the whiteness of a piece of white paper. And it has those people in that top class, that caste. The caste includes people of that coloration, and that's the top caste. So the ruling class has a large number of what we call white people in it, even though those people, most of them, are not part of the ruling class. Now, an underclass that we have is the black caste, and that includes most of the people of recent African descent and darker colored people. And then we look at that. So when you talk about justice and that sort of thing, it depends to a great degree about who the victims are and what caste they belong in. So if you in the black caste, for example, and most of the African-American people in there and Africans and so forth, you can't expect that it's just a matter of you being a citizen and be treated in terms of truth and justice and whatnot. So it depends on what caste you're in, how you are treated. And you can see that very easily if you look at the prison system, which is chock full of people in a lower caste, the black caste and Hispanic or Latino caste and so forth. So that is a big, big difference. So this idea of justice and being a citizen and all that, you know, that's maybe a factor, but that's not the main factor. What caste you in is a very important thing to look at. Now, right now, on the bestseller list is Wilkerson's book of caste, and that's worth reading. I've read it, and it's worthwhile reading. So that's the important thing, what caste you belong in and what kind of crime it was, and that has a big impact on how you're going to be in your quest for justice to see what is going to happen. So it is a very important thing. And we cannot ignore the caste system we have. The white caste being the dominant caste, with the ruling class in that caste, and the black caste being a low one. And you don't expect equal treatment for all people who are citizens, but it depends on what caste you belong in.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. Henry from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Chief, how's it going?
Okay, it's going.
All right, yeah, right over here, too, it's going. to your question, how many Derek Chauvins are out there? I don't have the numerical number. I don't think anybody has, but there are probably more Derek Chauvins and probably people that are worse than Derek Chauvins than we would probably. There are more of them than are those who are legitimately, you know, so-called good cops who actually, you know, do, you know, police work and actually care about the community. But in a sense, the system allows people for people like Derek Chauvin and the killers of, you know, Mike Brown and these other police officers who have, you know, killed unarmed black men and women over the years. They are allowed in this system. And we have to look at it as a system because of the fact that when you look at the history of it, this just didn't happen, you know, a couple of years ago. This is not a new phenomenon. We've had police killings in black communities, you know, for decades, centuries, even. It's just been recently being filmed now. And this is why all the attention is getting, you know, getting light to it now. But we have to look at it as a system. And, you know, Derek Chauvins are running around rampant in our communities, especially in cities where majority black people live at. So we have to, you know, we have to take that into account because they are allowed in this system. They are allowed to be police officers.
Okay, so you've been selected to serve on a jury in a scenario where you have a police officer facing charges for dispatching a citizen from this earth. If we apply your analysis and the analysis of individuals who called in today, what is the expectation of justice? How will it work, or will it work? What would you call justice?
Well, if I am lucky enough to not be stricken because of my beliefs and my conviction on racism and white supremacy and police brutality, for me, justice would look like him being prosecuted for murder. And I say that in a sense of, if he is a person, as an officer, your duty is to preserve life. I guess that's what the police oath is, or what they say. But obviously, he wasn't preserving any type of life. And in a sense, even in this sense, you can't even use qualified immunity where police officers, say, well, I was, my life was being threatened. Obviously, his life was not being threatened because this police officer had his knee on the guy's neck. So there was no actual threat. And even before that, there were a group of police officers who basically subdued, George Floyd. So that, from the evidence that I've seen so far, maybe there might be some more evidence that, George Floyd might have, had a Uzi machine gun under his shirt. I don't know. But from what I've seen, you can't even use qualified immunity on this one, where he says that his life was being threatened. So at this point, it has to be premeditated because of the fact that the guy was literally screaming that he couldn't breathe. So, like I said, you can't even say that it was, manslaughter, because it was definitely premeditated.
When you see the case this way, from an analytical point of view, as opposed to our common reaction, we tend to see these cases reactively. We don't break it down and figure out how much of what we are observing is about the caste system, as David says, or as Ed says, that the dynamic of the case as it starts out is about the synergy between the police and the state. So can we expect a completely objective trial? When you look at it that way, what do you see as the inevitable? What will happen, or more than likely happen, in this case?
Well, obviously, there will not be objectivity in this case in regards to who's going to rule. Now, Utrecht, is this a bench trial or is this a jury? I'm assuming this is a jury trial, since you asked me gave me the scenario if I was a juror, right?
Well, that's a very good question, because I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay. So, in a court case like this, obviously, you're not supposed to look at it, as many would look at it as a system. You're supposed to look at the case itself as an individualistic, isolated incident. And even in that sense, like I said, you can't really give any deference to what the actions of the police officer, because his life was not being threatened. But what I do think, and what I do think is going to happen, and I think this is the new trick of the system, and this was prevalent in what happened here in Chicago with the Jason Van Dyke trial, is that there's going to be more focus on just the conviction to just appease the public's outcry. And then they're going to give him 2 years, with good behavior, or or, you know, whatever. But, you know, he's going to get charged with the lowest rate of murder, and he's going to get like 2 years or 3 years. But I do see him being convicted, but at a very, very low rate of sentencing than what a normal person would get charged with, either first or second degree murder.
Do you have any thoughts about the fact that Chauvin is a single defendant here? Although he in fact was the leader of a team. And we don't see other members of the team being held to account in the same way that he allegedly is being held to account.
Well, yes, I see it as very problematic, because it just points, you know, it just points to complicity of one person. And obviously this guy was the guy who physically, you know, killed George Floyd. But at the same time, in the video, you see a number of cops. They're just looking. And then you have the one Asian cop who basically was trying to, you know, shoo people away and shoo the camera person away from, you know, from the video. So, yes, that's very problematic, because of the fact that there was a group of cops there who basically allowed that to happen.
So, as you as we observe the unfolding of this case, you see, this is how I like to cover a case. You study the dimensions of it, and suddenly the case opens up to be something completely different from what we expect. When the case starts, it is all laid out. Here's a guy that we are going to charge with murder. Yes, he's a cop and everything, but we're looking at his action in a particular circumstance, and we think this is why we charge him with first degree and second degree murder. Okay. Then you suddenly realize that you're talking about systems. This man, Chauvin, is not just an individual. He's part of a structure. He's part of a system himself. And then there's another overlapping system that is judging him, and they have a shared interest in that they are not part, the regular part of our society. One is playing the role of judge, and the other is in the role of a defendant. But there are two systems, both emanating from the same source, both having so much more in common than they do apart. And you have to ask the question about what then are the rights, the presumed rights, of individuals coming into such a system expecting justice, when there are so many apparent contradictions that any reasonable person would say, I don't know that they are strong enough to uphold their purpose for being in the trial. That is presuming we're talking about the judge or a jury, if there's one. But we have innate questions. Why do we have these nagging questions then? What is it that causes us, despite what we see, you know, it looks well ordered and it looks, you know, designed to achieve a proper determination, but still we're not taken in by it. What does that say about us?
I mean, it says a lot about us. It says a lot about the system that runs it. And, you know, for me, when you're talking about these two systems that have something in common, you know, and that commonality to me is white supremacy. you can't really, I mean, it goes to show the type of system we live in, the overall system that we live in. And it goes to show, too, that what you're going to see in this whole process, like I said, I do have a feeling that they're going to convict him, but give him a lesser charge just to basically appease the masses, and not on the strength of the case itself, because, you know, like you said, the case basically speaks for itself. But then obviously you're going to get, you know, the defendant and the defendant's lawyers. We're going to talk about George Floyd, and he was this and he was that, and bring all kind of nonsense about, you know, maybe a criminal past that he used to have, and basically look non-human. And so that's what they're going to go on the strength of, just to make it look like George Floyd was a threat to Derek Chauvin.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for today. We've come to the end of the program. I again apologize for I wasn't thinking until the door locked behind me, and I'm on the other side of it in the hallway. So we will devote more time to this discussion, one way or the other. It's going to get done. So tune in tomorrow, and we continue the conversation. If you would like to, you're invited to do so. But in any event, I intend to continue this conversation. Thanks so much for listening and for contributing so meaningfully. I always thank you for that, because it elevates the standard of the program and it provides views that are not normally heard. So thank you for that too. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.